Well, I hear there's already a problem with my sermon title, so we'll fix that. Repeat after me. Interstices.
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 Which are the little things between the bigger things. Sort of. Will you pray with me? Gracious God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. His was the briefest, and his was the saddest of ministries. Our 13th senior minister, unlucky 13. Samuel Horatio Stearns was his name, Stearns with an A. And he wanted this pulpit, he wanted this pastorate in the worst way. He could not have been prouder to have been offered it. To Samuel Horatio Stearns and to his family, there was no greater privilege, no higher calling than that of serving as the settled pastor over the Old South Church. It was said of Samuel Horatio Stearns that he was preeminently fitted for this position. Fitted by birth, but also by training and by intellectual and spiritual endowments. As to being fitted by birth, his father, both of his grandfathers, and his older brother were all clergymen. As to being fitted by endowment, he graduated second in his class at Harvard. It is the winter of 1833. The church is without a minister. Samuel Horatio Stearns preaches right here, and they like him. They like him a lot. He is persuaded to preach two more Sabbaths and to spend the week in between with the church. They like him. They like him a lot. The result, a unanimous call to Samuel Horatio Stearns to be settled as pastor over the Old South Church. However, before accepting the offer, Samuel Horatio Stearns reveals to the church that he is, in his own words, a confirmed invalid and has been his whole life. In fact, it took him many, many years to complete his studies at Harvard, as they were constantly interrupted by bouts of illness and failing health. He discloses to the church the situation. He hides nothing. Yet both he and the church choose to hope against hope. And so it is that Samuel Horatio Stearns is ordained and settled over this church. He preaches three Sundays and never preaches again. There follows a torturous journey of failing health, resting, gathering some strength, feeling better, only to relapse again into ill health and weakness and despondency. He offers to resign. The church refuses. For 2 years, this goes on. Hope rising, health returning, then health failing him. And month after month, hope deferred again. While Mr. Stearns' image was never captured on canvas or by pen, Augustus, his brother, writes this. Mr. Stearns was about 5 feet and 10 inches in height. His carriage was erect, his form light and spare, his head small and well turned, his eyes blue, large, and rolling, his face habitually pale, his brow overcast with a pensive but not joyless expression. When it becomes clear that there is no hope of his recovery, that he is, in fact, dying, Samuel Horatio Stearns writes a letter of resignation. He writes, I love the Old South and have never ceased to remember you in my prayers since the morning I became your pastor. A pastor's feelings for his people are peculiar. I wish I could address you and say, farewell. The effort to write the letter, pouring into it his passions and his profound affections, costs him dearly, and he dies shortly thereafter. It is but a few months later that the pew proprietors call the deacons and asking them to call a meeting to consider the subject of choosing another minister. At that meeting, the name of the Reverend George W. Blagden is put forth. If Mr. Stearns was slight and sickly, if in his brother's words his form was light and spare, Dr. Blagden is hale and hearty and apparently not hard to look at. In the history of Old South Church, we read, Mr. Blagden was very attractive in his personal appearance and scholarly in his attainments and highly acceptable as a writer and speaker. Blagden is in many ways a perfect choice, but for one thing, he is already a settled pastor over another church whose interests, and I'm quoting history, would greatly suffer should Old South steal him away. This is the year 1836, and over the course of the preceding 167 years of our history, this church had never called a settled pastor, never, in other words, stolen a pastor from another pulpit. Our first two ministers, Thatcher and Willard, had been called from retirement to serve, and the 11 who followed them had all been called as young men fresh from their studies. As our history records it, this is a matter not only of tradition by now, but of some principle. At the first meeting of the church at which they consider the proposal to call Mr. Blagden, the church is divided. 13 vote against and 10 are in favor. A second meeting is held 2 months later. At this meeting, our church considers a letter from Mr. Blagden's church, the Salem Street Church, pleading with us to suspend any further consideration of considering their pastor until they have had a chance to confer with him. However, it seems that Mr. Blagden, over whom the two churches are waging a polite, if rather fierce, behind-the-scenes tug-of-war, has made up his mind already. He has decided to leave the Salem Street Church. And that is enough for the Old South Church leaders. Deacon Armstrong makes the following motion at this following meeting. And I quote, voted that the Old South Church do hereby call the Reverend George W. Blagden to become their pastor, provided, and this is in the motion, his connection with his present charge be in a regular and Christian manner dissolved. This time the vote is a landslide. 20 in favor, none opposed, and we have to assume that his relation with the Salem Street Church was in a regular and Christian manner dissolved. A contemporary wrote this of our Mr. Blagden. As regards his character, he was one of the most truly lovable men I ever knew. His sermons were the utterances of a man in so familiar conversance with sacred things that their language was his vernacular. Always reverent, always fervent, he made a profound impression upon his hearers. During Mr. Blagden's pastorate, the city begins to change dramatically. Families are deserting this part of town. The residences and mansion houses that had once dominated the neighborhood are being replaced by blocks of warehouses, warehouse after warehouse after warehouse. The neighborhood is becoming unbecoming. Noisy with traffic and commerce, smelly with fish houses, warehouses, and taverns. leaders of Old South Church begin raising the question of whether to remove to a more advantageous location. It is a conversation and an argument that will consume many meetings, many letters, and many hours of lawyering across the next 3 decades. Should we, dare we leave this meeting house, known as the Sanctuary of Freedom, the house in which Samuel Adams, James Otis, and Joseph Warren conspired to birth a new nation, the house of our forebears? And not least, dare we vacate and relinquish the land, the very land on which we are now, given up to us by Madam Norton, as her will stated, to be used for the worship of God forever. In the meantime, as the city around us grows, as our ministries grow and expand, it is decided to bring in a colleague pastor with Mr. Blagden. Having gotten over the principle about not stealing pastors from other churches, we promptly steal Jacob Merrill Manning from the Mystic Congregational Church in Medford. Medford's over there, Medford, Massachusetts. Mr. Manning sets about to build up the Sunday schools, the chapels, and the churches that Old South is a part of planting and developing around the city, as well as bringing in new members to this church. And then in the year 1861, there is the attack on Fort Sumter in South Carolina, and the Civil War is launched. On May 1st, 1861, in the presence of a large crowd with prayer, speeches, and martial music, amongst much patriotic fervor, there is a flag raising here at the Old South. Due to Jacob Manning's leanings as a radical abolitionist and his fervent support of the war to end slavery, this building becomes the most significant recruiting station for the Union Army for many, many miles around. Over 1,000 men sign up here. And having done so, they ask that our associate minister, Reverend Jacob Manning, accompany them to war as their chaplain. The church grants Mr. Manning leave and agrees to pay him a salary while he is at war. Chaplain Manning travels with the Massachusetts 43rd Volunteer Regiment to North Carolina. His chaplain's tent on the field of war is a place of refuge, a place of humanity and kindness and relief from the hellish and grisly misery of the battlefield. However, Chaplain Manning is seized himself with malarial fever, and though he returns to Boston and returns to the Old South Church, he never fully recovers. Once the war is ended, the church revisits the question of removing from this location to a more favorable neighborhood, closer to the residential areas, away from the grit and the grime, the pong and the racket of this now almost holy commercial district. Those who favor that we remain here do so, it is argued, primarily out of patriotic associations. Quoting from a sermon on the topic by our Jacob Manning, "The fact that Franklin was baptized here, that the great orators of the Revolution were born here, that the British soldiery was quartered here, events like these have no heavenly savor to them. The public," he continued, "is interested in us more on account of these political associations than because we are a Church of Christ." Manning then proceeds to speak of the great work which confronts the Church of Christ in that day and argues that we can accomplish that work more effectively from a different location, a residential location. While the church continues to debate this painful and contentious subject, there occurs a momentous event, a terrifying and awful event. In fact, you could argue that the Great Boston Fire of 1872 made the decision for us. Saturday evening, November 9th, 1872, is a lovely evening in Boston. Bostonians are out strolling, enjoying a mild fall evening. At 7 p.m., not far from the meeting house, a spark in a factory basement catches fire. Now, Boston has grown rapidly in the post-war years, rapidly but also randomly, haphazardly. It is all narrow streets, no building codes, not enough fire engines, too few fire alarm boxes, old rusted pipes, poor water supplies, and devastatingly, too many highly combustible mansard roofs. To make matters worse, the fire breaks out during a severe epidemic of horse distemper. With the animals too weak to work, the firefighters are forced to haul their engines and equipment by hand. Less than an hour after the first shouts of fire are heard, Boston's fire captain, having sized up just how dire the situation is, does what no other fire captain has ever done before him. He signals an order to telegram every town within 50 miles to send every man and every engine available. He orders tugboats to spray and soak the bridges and the wharves in Boston Harbor. He deploys his engines and crews to surround the fire to do their best to contain it. But it is as if hell itself has broken loose upon the town. The rampaging fire is consuming an entire city block every hour. Swirling overhead, leaping from roof to roof, the fire is above and beyond the spray of the waters. And to make matters worse, to make matters harder for the firefighters, enormous crowds are gathered outside. It is as if, in fact, the entire city has turned out to watch the eerie, terrifying, magnetic beauty of the fire beast. Many are gawkers, some are looters, and some are business owners seeking to save whatever they can. Nevertheless, they impede the firefighters who struggle to haul heavy equipment through narrow, cobbled lanes filled with panicked and gaping people. Early on, it was thought Trinity Church could be saved. But as the morning approaches, it is clear she cannot be. Reverend Phillips Brooks and others begin to carry out precious objects from the church to rescue them. As Trinity Church finally succumbs, Reverend Phillips Brooks watches helplessly. "She burnt majestically," he later wrote, and added this, "I did not know how much I liked the great gloomy old thing till I saw her windows bursting." The fire is raging through Winthrop Square, but the captain sees an opportunity to contain it on the south, at the harbor's edge, and on the east, and here at the Old South Church. He identifies this meeting house as one of the lines he thinks he can hold. The building is a beloved symbol of Boston's revolutionary spirit, one of the few remaining colonial structures, but more than that, if he can end the maelstrom here, he can save City Hall, the State House, and Beacon Hill. It is 5 a.m. now. The captain orders men up on to the roof and into the tower. They soak the roof and lay wet carpets and blankets everywhere they can. They brush away and they stamp out every spark that lands. With men on the roof and engines and more men below, they battle to save the church and hold the line. It is in the nick of time. Just as the firefighters are about to crack under the strain of weariness, about to lose the battle, that there arrives a steam engine from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The new equipment and fresh fighter fires win the day. While this meeting house is saved, it is badly damaged. That day, our meeting house is taken possession of by the municipal authorities for the accommodation of troops that are called out to guard the burnt district. That afternoon, Sunday, 145 years ago this month, Jacob Manning conducts a service of worship here for those troops, It is believed to have been the last service held within these venerable walls while this church was still in possession of the meeting house. Dear Old South Church, here is what I know. While our long, venerable history is studded with storied events and great personages, it is in the interstices, in the spaces between, in the long, lengthy, sometimes contentious deliberations, that we carry on the work of being an Ermid church today. It is in the everyday slogging and hauling that we sketch and design and fashion and build the blocks and pieces that one by one bring the architecture of our faith into view. Maybe 100 years from today, our descendants will tell the story of a church that once dared wager sunlight for affordable home ownership, a church that fought for the beauty of sacred spaces, that battled against commercialism and urban sprawl, fighting for a sanctuary in the city. Maybe 100 years from today, our descendants will tell the story of how once upon a time, across the years 2016 and 2017, Trinity Church, Old South Church, and Greater Boston Interfaith Organization linked arms and linked fortunes and fought for a seat at the table where matters of affordable housing are decided in the city. If our descendants tell this tale, the names of Carolyn Arrington and Marie Hurd, of Emily Click and John Edgerton, of Sheila Randolph and Deborah Rui and Kathy Wade, of Deb Washington and our church council, of Randy Billings and the trustees will be uttered and spoken with reverence and awe. Don't forget the interstices. Don't overlook or dismiss what happens in between. That's where it counts. That's where we and God do the planning, the praying, the Bible study, the ethical discernment, the behind-the-scenes preparations that prepare us for the real time. If the devil's in the details, I wager this, God is in the interstices. Amen?